chapter 53, the earlier judges. After the settlement in Canaan, the tribes made no vigorous effort to complete the conquest of the land. Satisfied with the territory already gained, their zeal soon flagged, and the war was discontinued. When Israel was strong, they put the Canaanites to tribute and did not utterly drive them out. The Lord had faithfully fulfilled on his part the promises made to Israel. Joshua had broken the power of the Canaanites and had distributed the land to the tribes. It only remained for them, trusting in the assurance of divine aid, to complete the work of dispossessing the inhabitants of the land. But this they failed to do. By entering into league with the Canaanites, they directly transgressed the command of God, and thus failed to fulfill the condition on which he had promised to place them in possession of Canaan. From the very first communication of God with them at Sinai, they had been warned against idolatry. Immediately after the proclamation of the law, the message was sent them by Moses concerning the nations of Canaan: "Thou shalt not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do after their works. But thou shalt utterly overthrow them, and quite break down their images. And ye shall serve the Lord your God, and he shall bless thy bread and thy water, and I will take sickness away from the midst of thee." The assurance was given that so long as they remained obedient, God would subdue their enemies before them. "I will send my fear before thee, and will destroy all the people to whom thou shalt come. And I will make all thine enemies turn their backs unto thee. And I will send hornets before thee, which shall drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, and the Hittite from before thee. I will not drive them out from before thee in 1 year, lest the land become desolate, and the beasts of the field multiply against thee. By little and little I will drive them out from before thee, until thou be increased and inherit the land. I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and thou shalt drive them out before thee. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor with their gods. They shall not dwell in thy land, lest they make thee sin against me. For if thou serve their gods, it will surely be a snare unto thee." These directions were reiterated in the most solemn manner by Moses before his death, and they were repeated by Joshua. God had placed his people in Canaan as a mighty breastwork to stay the tide of moral evil, that it might not flood the world. If faithful to him, God intended that Israel should go on conquering and to conquer. He would give into their hands nations greater and more powerful than the Canaanites. The promise was, "If ye shall diligently keep all these commandments which I command you, then will the Lord drive out all these nations from before you, and ye shall possess greater nations and mightier than yourselves. Every place whereon the soles of your feet shall tread shall be yours, from the wilderness and Lebanon, from the river Euphrates, even unto the uttermost sea shall your coast be. There shall no man be able to stand before you, for the Lord your God shall lay the fear of you and the dread of you upon all the land that ye shall tread upon, as he has said unto you." But regardless of their high destiny, they chose the course of ease and self-indulgence. They let slip their opportunities for completing the conquest of the land, and for many generations they were afflicted by the remnant of these idolatrous peoples that were, as the prophet had foretold, as pricks in their eyes and as thorns in their sides. The Israelites were mingled among the heathen and learned their works. They intermarried with the Canaanites, and idolatry spread like a plague throughout the land. They served their idols, which were a snare unto them. Yea, they sacrificed their sons and their daughters unto devils, and the land was polluted with blood. Therefore was the wrath of the Lord kindled against his people, insomuch that he abhorred his own inheritance. Until the generation that had received instruction from Joshua became extinct, idolatry made little headway, but the parents had prepared the way for the apostasy of their children. The disregard of the Lord's restrictions on the part of those who came in possession of Canaan sowed seeds of evil that continued to bring forth bitter fruit for many generations. The simple habits of the Hebrews had secured them physical health, but association with the heathen led to the indulgence of appetite and passion, which gradually lessened physical strength and enfeebled the mental and moral powers. By their sins, the Israelites were separated from God. His strength was removed from them, and they could no longer prevail against their enemies. Thus, they were brought into subjection to the very nations that through God they might have subdued. They forsook the Lord God of their fathers, which brought them out of the land of Egypt, and guided them in the wilderness like a flock. They provoked him to anger with their high places and moved him to jealousy with their graven images. Therefore the Lord forsook the tabernacle of Shiloh, the tent which he placed among them, and delivered his strength into captivity and his glory into the enemy's hand. Yet he did not utterly forsake his people. There was ever a remnant who were true to Jehovah, and from time to time the Lord raised up faithful and valiant men to put down idolatry and to deliver the Israelites from their enemies. But when the deliverer was dead and the people were released from his authority, they would gradually return to their idols. And thus the story of backsliding and chastisement, of confession and deliverance, was repeated again and again. The king of Mesopotamia, the king of Moab, and after them the Philistines and the Canaanites of Hazor, led by Sisera, in turn became the oppressors of Israel. Othniel, Shamgar, and Ehud, Deborah, and Barak were raised up as deliverers of their people. But again the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian. Heretofore the hand of the oppressor had fallen but lightly upon the tribes dwelling east of the Jordan, but in the present calamities they were the first sufferers. The Amalekites on the south of Canaan, as well as the Midianites on its eastern border and in the deserts beyond, were still the unrelenting enemies of Israel. The latter nation had been nearly destroyed by the Israelites in the days of Moses, but they had since increased greatly and had become numerous and powerful. They had thirsted for revenge, and now that the protecting hand of God was withdrawn from Israel, the opportunity had come. Not alone the tribes east of Jordan, but the whole land suffered from their ravages. The wild, fierce inhabitants of the desert, as locusts for multitude, came swarming into the land with their flocks and herds. Like a devouring plague, they spread over the country from the river Jordan to the Philistine plain. They came as soon as the harvest began to ripen and remained until the last fruits of the earth had been gathered. They stripped the fields of their increase and robbed and maltreated the inhabitants and then returned to the deserts. Thus the Israelites, dwelling in the open country, were forced to abandon their homes and to congregate in walled towns, to seek refuge in fortresses, or even to find shelter in caves and rocky fastnesses among the mountains. For 7 years this oppression continued, and then as the people in their distress gave heed to the Lord's reproof and confessed their sins, God again raised up a helper for them. Gideon was the son of Joash of the tribe of Manasseh. The division to which this family belonged held no leading position, but the household of Joash was distinguished for courage and integrity. Of his brave sons, it is said, each one resembled the children of a king. All but one had fallen in the struggles against the Midianites, and he had caused his name to be feared by the invaders. To Gideon came the divine call to deliver his people. He was engaged at the time in threshing wheat. A small quantity of grain had been concealed, and not daring to beat it out on the ordinary threshing floor, he had resorted to a spot near the wine press, for the season of ripe grapes being still far off, little notice was now taken of the vineyards. As Gideon labored in secrecy and silence, he sadly pondered upon the condition of Israel and considered how the oppressor's yoke might be broken from off his people. Suddenly the angel of the Lord appeared and addressed him with the words, "Jehovah is with thee, thou mighty man of valor." "O my Lord," was his answer, "if the Lord be with us, why then is all this befallen us? And where be all his miracles which our fathers told us of, saying, 'Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt?' But now the Lord hath forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites." The messenger of heaven replied, "Go in this thy might, and thou shalt save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have not I sent thee?" Gideon desired some token that the one now addressing him was the covenant angel who in the past had wrought for Israel. Angels of God who communed with Abraham had once tarried to share his hospitality, and Gideon now entreated the divine messenger to remain as his guest. Hastening to his tent, he prepared from his scanty store a kid and unleavened cakes, which he brought forth and set before him. But the angel bade him take the flesh and the unleavened cakes and lay them upon this rock and pour out the broth. Gideon did so, and then the sign which he had desired was given. With the staff in his hand, the angel touched the flesh and the unleavened cakes, and a flame bursting from the rock consumed the sacrifice. Then the angel vanished from his sight. Gideon's father, Joash, who shared in the apostasy of his countrymen, had erected at Ophrah, where he dwelt, a large altar to Baal, at which the people of the town worshipped. Gideon was commanded to destroy this altar and to erect an altar to Jehovah over the rock on which the offering had been consumed, and there to present a sacrifice to the Lord. The offering of sacrifice to God had been committed to the priests and had been restricted to the altar at Shiloh. But he who had established the ritual service and to whom all its offerings pointed had power to change its requirements. The deliverance of Israel was to be preceded by a solemn protest against the worship of Baal. Gideon must declare war upon idolatry before going out to battle with the enemies of his people. The divine direction was faithfully carried out. Knowing that he would be opposed if it were attempted openly, Gideon performed the work in secret with the aid of his servants, accomplishing the whole in one night. Great was the rage of the men of Ophrah when they came next morning to pay their devotions to Baal. They would have taken Gideon's life had not Joash, who had been told of the angel's visit, stood in defense of his son. "Will ye plead for Baal?" said Joash. "Will ye save him? He that will plead for him, let him be put to death while it is yet morning. If he be a god, let him plead for himself, because one hath cast down his altar." If Baal could not defend his own altar, how could he be trusted to protect his worshippers? All thoughts of violence toward Gideon were dismissed, and when he sounded the trumpet of war, the men of Ophrah were among the first to gather to his standard. Heralds were dispatched to his own tribe of Manasseh, and also to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, and all answered to the call. Gideon dared not place himself at the head of the army without still further evidence that God had called him to this work, and that he would be with him. He prayed, "If thou wilt save Israel by mine hand, as thou hast said, behold, I will put a fleece of wool in the floor, and if the dew be on the fleece only, and it be dry upon all the earth besides, then shall I know that thou wilt save Israel by mine hand, as thou hast said." In the morning the fleece was yet, while the ground was dry, but now a doubt arose, since wool naturally absorbs moisture when there is any in the air, the test might not be decisive. Hence he asked that the sign be reversed, pleading that his extreme caution might not displease the Lord. His request was granted. Thus encouraged, Gideon led out his forces to give battle to the invaders. All the Midianites and the Amalekites and the children of the east were gathered together and went over and pitched in the valley of Jezreel. The entire force under Gideon's command numbered only 32,000 men, but with the vast host of the enemy spread out before him, the word of the Lord came to him, "The people that are with thee are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, Mine own hand hath saved me. Now therefore go to, proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, Whosoever is fearful and afraid, let him return and depart early from Mount Gilead. Those who are unwilling to face danger and hardships, or whose worldly interests would draw their hearts from the work of God, would add no strength to the armies of Israel. Their presence would prove only a cause of weakness. It had been made a law in Israel that before they went to battle, the following proclamation should be made throughout the army. What man is there that hath built a new house and hath not dedicated it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man dedicate it. And what man is he that hath planted a vineyard and hath not eaten of it? Let him also go and return unto his house, lest he die in the battle and another man eat of it. And what man is there that hath betrothed a wife and hath not taken her? Let him go and return unto his house, lest he die in the battle and another man take her. And the officers were to speak further to the people, saying, What man is there that is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return unto his house, lest his brethren's heart faint as well as his heart. Because his numbers were so few compared with those of the enemy, Gideon had refrained from making the usual proclamation. He was filled with astonishment at the declaration that his army was too large. But the Lord saw the pride and unbelief existing in the hearts of his people. Aroused by the stirring appeals of Gideon, they had readily enlisted. But many were filled with fear when they saw the multitudes of the Midianites. Yet had Israel triumphed, those very ones would have taken the glory themselves instead of ascribing the victory to God. Gideon obeyed the Lord's directions, and with a heavy heart he saw 22,000, or more than two-thirds of his entire force, depart for their homes. Again the word of the Lord came to him, The people are yet too many, bring them down under the water, and I will try them for thee there. And it shall be that of whom I say unto thee, This shall go with thee, the same shall go with thee. And of whomsoever I say unto thee, This shall not go with thee, the same shall not go. The people were led down to the waterside, expecting to make an immediate advance upon the enemy. A few hastily took a little water in the hand and sucked it up as they went on. But nearly all bowed upon their knees and leisurely drank from the surface of the stream. Those who took of the water in their hands were but 300 out of 10,000, yet these were selected, all the rest were permitted to return to their homes. By the simplest means, character is often tested. Those who in time of peril were intent upon supplying their own wants were not the men to be trusted in an emergency. The Lord has no place in His work for the indolent and self-indulgent. The men of His choice were the few who would not permit their own wants to delay them in the discharge of duty. The 300 chosen men not only possessed courage and self-control, but they were men of faith. They had not defiled themselves with idolatry. God could direct them, and through them He could work deliverance for Israel. Success does not depend upon numbers. God can deliver by few as well as by many. He is honored not so much by the great numbers as by the character of those who serve Him. The Israelites were stationed on the brow of a hill overlooking the valley where the hosts of the invaders lay encamped. And the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the children of the east lay along in the valley like locusts for multitude, and their camels were without number as the sand which is upon the seashore for multitude. Gideon trembled as he thought of the conflict of the morrow, but the Lord spoke to him in the night season and bade him with Phurah his attendant go down to the camp of the Midianites, intimating that he would there hear something for his encouragement. He went, and waiting in the darkness and silence, he heard a soldier relating a dream to his companion. Lo, a cake of barley bread tumbled into the host of Midian and came unto a tent and smote it that it fell and overturned it that the tent lay along. The other answered in words that stirred the heart of that unseen listener, This is nothing else save the sword of Gideon the son of Joash, a man of Israel, for into his hand hath God delivered Midian and all the host. Gideon recognized the voice of God speaking to him through those Midianitish strangers. Returning to the few men under his command, he said, Arise, for the Lord hath delivered into your hand the host of Midian. By divine direction, a plan of attack was suggested to him, which he immediately set out to execute. The 300 men were divided into three companies. To every man were given a trumpet and a torch concealed in an earthen pitcher. The men were stationed in such a manner as to approach the Midianite camp from different directions. In the dead of night, at a signal from Gideon's war horn, the three companies sounded their trumpets. Then breaking their pitchers and displaying the blazing torches, they rushed upon the enemy with the terrible war cry, "The sword of the Lord and of Gideon." The sleeping army was suddenly aroused. Upon every direction was seen the light of the flaming torches. In every direction was heard the sound of trumpets with the cry of the assailants. Believing themselves at the mercy of an overwhelming force, the Midianites were panic-stricken. With wild cries of alarm, they fled for life, and mistaking their own companions for enemies, they slew one another. As the news of the victory spread, thousands of the men of Israel who had been dismissed to their homes returned and joined in pursuit of their fleeing enemies. The Midianites were making their way toward the Jordan, hoping to reach their own territory beyond the river. Gideon sent messengers to the tribe of Ephraim, rousing them to intercept the fugitives at the southern fords. Meanwhile, with his 300, faint yet pursuing, Gideon crossed the stream hard after those who had already gained the farther side. The two princes, Zebah and Zalmunna, who had been over the entire host and who had escaped with an army of 15,000 men, were overtaken by Gideon, their force completely scattered, and the leaders captured and slain. In this signal defeat, not less than 120,000 of the invaders perished. The power of the Midianites was broken so that they were never again able to make war upon Israel. The tidings spread swiftly far and wide that Israel's God had again fought for his people. No words can describe the terror of the surrounding nations when they learned what simple means had prevailed against the power of a bold, warlike people. The leader whom God chose to overthrow the Midianites occupied no prominent position in Israel. He was not a ruler, a priest, or a Levite. He thought himself the least in his father's house, but God saw in him a man of courage and integrity. He was distrustful of himself and willing to follow the guidance of the Lord. God does not always choose for his work men of the greatest talents, but he selects those whom he can best use. Before honor is humility. The Lord can work most effectually through those who are most sensible of their own insufficiency and who will rely upon him as their leader and source of strength. He will make them strong by uniting their weakness to his might and wise by connecting their ignorance with his wisdom. If they would cherish true humility, the Lord could do much more for his people. But there are few who can be trusted with any large measure of responsibility or success without becoming self-confident and forgetful of their dependence upon God. This is why, in choosing the instruments for his work, the Lord passes by those whom the world honors as great, talented, and brilliant. They are too often proud and self-sufficient. They feel competent to act without counsel from God. The simple act of blowing a blast upon the trumpet by the army of Joshua around Jericho and by Gideon's little band about the hosts of Midian was made effectual through the power of God to overthrow the might of his enemies. The most complete system that men have ever devised, apart from the power and wisdom of God, will prove a failure, while the most unpromising methods will succeed when divinely appointed and entered upon with humility and faith. Trust in God and obedience to his will are as essential to the Christian in the spiritual warfare as to Gideon and Joshua in their battles with the Canaanites. By the repeated manifestations of his power in behalf of Israel, God would lead them to have faith in him with confidence to seek his help in every emergency. He is just as willing to work with the efforts of his people now and to accomplish great things through weak instrumentalities. All heaven awaits our demand upon its wisdom and strength. God is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that we ask or think. Gideon returned from pursuing the enemies of the nation to meet censure and accusation from his own countrymen. When at his call the men of Israel had rallied against the Midianites, the tribe of Ephraim had remained behind. They looked upon the effort as a perilous undertaking, and as Gideon sent them no special summons, they availed themselves of this excuse not to join their brethren. But when the news of Israel's triumph reached them, the Ephraimites were envious because they had not shared it. After the rout of the Midianites, the men of Ephraim had, by Gideon's direction, seized the fords of the Jordan, thus preventing the escape of the fugitives. By this means, a large number of the enemy were slain, among whom were two princes, Oreb and Zeb. Thus the men of Ephraim followed up the battle and helped complete the victory. Nevertheless, they were jealous and angry, as though Gideon had been led by his own will and judgment. They did not discern God's hand in the triumph of Israel. They did not appreciate his power and mercy in their deliverance, and this very act showed them unworthy to be chosen as his special instruments. Returning with the trophies of victory, they angrily reproached Gideon, "Why hast thou served us thus, that thou callest us not when thou wentest to fight with the Midianites? What have I done now in comparison of you?" said Gideon. "Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? God hath delivered into your hand the princes of Midian, Oreb, and Zeb. What was I able to do in comparison of you?" The spirit of jealousy might easily have been fanned into a quarrel that would have caused strife and bloodshed, but Gideon's modest answer soothed the anger of the men of Ephraim, and they returned in peace to their homes. Firm and uncompromising where principle was concerned, and in war a mighty man of valor, Gideon displayed also a spirit of courtesy that is rarely witnessed. The men of Israel, in their gratitude at deliverance from the Midianites, proposed to Gideon that he should become their king, and that the throne should be confirmed to his descendants. This proposition was in direct violation of the principles of the theocracy. God was the king of Israel, and for them to place a man upon the throne would be a rejection of their divine sovereign. Gideon recognized this fact. His answer shows how true and noble were his motives. "I will not rule over you," he declared, "neither shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." But Gideon was betrayed into another error, which brought disaster upon his house and upon all Israel. The season of inactivity that succeeds a great struggle is often fraught with greater danger than is the period of conflict. To this danger Gideon was now exposed. A spirit of unrest was upon him. Hitherto he had been content to fulfill the directions given him from God. But now, instead of waiting for divine guidance, he began to plan for himself. When the armies of the Lord have gained a signal victory, Satan will redouble his efforts to overthrow the work of God. Thus thoughts and plans were suggested to the mind of Gideon by which the people were led astray. Because he had been commanded to offer sacrifice upon the rock where the angel appeared to him, Gideon concluded that he had been appointed to officiate as a priest. Without waiting for the divine sanction, he determined to provide a suitable place and to institute a system of worship similar to that carried on at the tabernacle. With a strong popular feeling in his favor, he found no difficulty in carrying out his plan. At his request, all the earrings of gold taken from the Midianites were given him as his share of the spoil. The people also collected many other costly materials together with richly adorned garments of the princes of Midian. From the material thus furnished, Gideon constructed an ephod and a breastplate, an imitation of those worn by the high priest. His course proved a snare to himself and his family as well as to Israel. The unauthorized worship led many of the people finally to forsake the Lord altogether to serve idols. After Gideon's death, great numbers, among whom were his own family, joined in this apostasy. The people were led away from God by the very man who had once overthrown their idolatry. There are few who realize how far-reaching is the influence of their words and acts, how often the errors of the parents produce the most disastrous effects upon their children and children's children, long after the actors themselves have been laid in the grave. Everyone is exerting an influence upon others and will be held accountable for the result of that influence. Words and actions have a telling power, and the long hereafter will show the effect of our life here. The impression made by our words and deeds will surely react upon ourselves in blessing or in cursing. This thought gives an awful solemnity to life and should draw us to God in humble prayer that He will guide us by His wisdom. Those who stand in the highest positions may lead astray. The wisest err, the strongest may falter and stumble. There is need that light from above should be constantly shed upon our pathway. Our only safety lies in trusting our way implicitly to Him who has said, "Follow me." After the death of Gideon, the children of Israel remembered not the Lord their God, who had delivered them out of the hands of all their enemies on every side. Neither showed they kindness to the house of Jerubbaal, namely Gideon, according to all the goodness which he had showed unto Israel. Forgetful of all they owed to Gideon, their judge and deliverer, the people of Israel accepted his base-born son Abimelech as their king, who to sustain his power murdered all but one of Gideon's lawful children. When men cast off the fear of God, they are not long in departing from honor and integrity. An appreciation of the Lord's mercy will lead to an appreciation of those who, like Gideon, have been employed as instruments to bless his people. The cruel course of Israel toward the house of Gideon was what might be expected from a people who manifested so great ingratitude to God. After the death of Abimelech, the rule of judges who feared the Lord served for a time to put a check upon idolatry, but ere long the people returned to the practices of the heathen communities around them. Among the northern tribes, the gods of Syria and Sidon had many worshippers. On the southwest, the idols of the Philistines, and on the east, those of Moab and Ammon, had turned the hearts of Israel from the God of their fathers. But apostasy speedily brought its judgment. The Ammonites subdued the eastern tribes and, crossing the Jordan, invaded the territory of Judah and Ephraim. On the west, the Philistines came up from their plain beside the sea, burning and pillaging far and near. Again, Israel seemed to be abandoned to the power of relentless foes. Again, the people sought help from him whom they had so forsaken and insulted. The children of Israel cried unto the Lord, saying, "We have sinned against thee, both because we have forsaken our God and also served Balaam." But sorrow had not worked true repentance. The people mourned because their sins had brought suffering upon themselves, not because they had dishonored God by transgression of His holy law. True repentance is more than sorrow for sin. It is a resolute turning away from evil. The Lord answered them through one of His prophets, "Did I not deliver you from the Egyptians and from the Amorites, from the children of Ammon, and from the Philistines? The Zidonians also and the Amalekites and the Maonites did oppress you, yet, and ye cried to me, and I delivered you out of their hand. Yet ye have forsaken me and served other gods. Wherefore I will deliver you no more. Go and cry unto the gods which ye have chosen. Let them deliver you in the time of your tribulation." These solemn and fearful words carry the mind forward to another scene, the great day of final judgment, when the rejecters of God's mercy and the despisers of His grace shall be brought face to face with His justice. At that tribunal must they render an account who have devoted their God-given talents of time, of means, or of intellect to serving the gods of this world. They have forsaken their true and loving friend to follow the path of convenience and worldly pleasure. They intended at some time to return to God, but the world with its follies and deceptions absorbed the attention. Frivolous amusements, pride of dress, indulgence of appetite hardened the heart and benumbed the conscience so that the voice of truth was not heard. Duty was despised. Things of infinite value were lightly esteemed until the heart lost all desire to sacrifice for Him who has given so much for man. But in the reaping time they will gather that which they have sown. Saith the Lord, "I have called, and ye refused. I have stretched out my hand, and no man regarded. But ye have set at naught all my counsel, and would none of my reproof. When your fear cometh as desolation, and your destruction cometh as a whirlwind, when distress and anguish cometh upon you, then shall they call upon me, but I will not answer. They shall seek me early, but they shall not find me. For that they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord. They would none of my counsel, they despised all my reproof. Therefore shall they eat of the fruit of their own way, and be filled with their own devices. But whoso hearkeneth unto me shall dwell safely, and shall be quiet from fear of evil." The Israelites now humbled themselves before the Lord, and they put away the strange gods from among them, and served Jehovah. And the Lord's heart of love was grieved for the misery of Israel. Oh, the long-suffering mercy of our God, when His people put away the sins that had shut out His presence, He heard their prayers and at once began to work for them. A deliverer was raised up in the person of Jephthah, a Gileadite, who made war with the Ammonites and effectually destroyed their power. For 18 years at this time, Israel had suffered under the oppression of her foes. Yet again the lesson taught by suffering was forgotten. As the people returned to their evil ways, the Lord permitted them to be still oppressed by their powerful enemies, the Philistines. For many years they were constantly harassed and at times completely subjugated by this cruel and warlike nation. They had mingled with these idolaters, uniting with them in pleasure and in worship, until they seemed to be one with them in spirit and interest. Then these professed friends of Israel became their bitterest enemies and sought by every means to accomplish their destruction. Like Israel, Christians too often yield to the influence of the world and conform to its principles and customs in order to secure the friendship of the ungodly. But in the end, it will be found that these professed friends are the most dangerous of foes. The Bible plainly teaches that there can be no harmony between the people of God and the world. Marvel not, my brethren, if the world hates you. Our Savior says, "Ye know that it hated me before it hated you." Satan works through the ungodly under cover of a pretended friendship to allure God's people into sin, that he may separate them from him. And when their defense is removed, then he will lead his agents to turn against them and seek to accomplish their destruction.